There are other things that happen that I won't go through, but they're all pretty exciting, let's say. And when they're all over, the kid isn't the kid he was before he came. A lot has happened. His body has been changed, and he's then sent back to the girls. And there's one of them already selected to be his wife, and he's now a guaranteed little man. And he's going to behave as a man of this crowd ought to behave. That's not quite the way we educate our youngsters. We have another idea for them. The traditional notion of a mature adult is a person who behaves as he ought to behave, who behaves as the society has always asked him to behave. Grandpa behaved this way. So did great-grandpa. And every kid who didn't was eaten. So we all behave this way. That is to say, the adult is the one who accepts and represents the order of the society without question. This you get in all traditional societies. Now you know what we call a person who behaves that way. This we call a stuffed shirt. He has never built anything particular out of himself. He has simply done as told. He's sure of what's right and what's wrong, and that's that. Now, we can't have this anymore. And we don't want it. Our notion in our society today of an adult mind is a mind that accepts responsibility for its own actions, that judges in terms of values, not saying, oh, I want this because I like it, but in terms of an ordered and considered value scale. The individual is to judge, the individual is to criticize, and the individual is to represent with courage and loyalty his judgments. Now, this asks a lot of the society itself that wasn't asked before. This also tends to shatter the idea of authority. Now, that idea was formally validated by saying it came from God. The Lord of the universe ordered things this way for the society. A point I want to make is this, that all of these divine interpretations of local laws, of local social orders, are simply cooked up. They're not true. The society has changed with time. These are functions of conditions, of geography and history. One must realize that the moral order is in flux, is changing. There is no God-given right, wrong, true, false, moral, immoral. And with that kind of relativism, one is free to live as a human being, not simply as a, robot repeating patterns that have been enforced from the past. And so we have a much more sophisticated idea toward the social order. However, when it comes to this other problem of the natural order, one's nature as man, the thing is not quite so relativistic. Now, the next stage in the mystery of the human development is that of old age coming on. Just about when you learn how to do what they've been trying to teach you, you begin to fumble. And then you have to sort of pull yourself together and for another few years act as though you still could do it. And then everybody else begins to see he's not doing so well. They put another waiter in to take over the job for you and that kind of thing. And you're gradually eased out. In other words, the first function of the local social mythology was to bring you from childhood dependency to responsibility in terms of the social demands. And then just about when you're beginning to feel good about it all, the society that has said, you've got to do what we want, begins to say, well, it looks as though you can't do what we want, so you're on your own. Then you have what's called a nervous breakdown. The next problem, then, in a mythological order that is going to take care of us, is to tell us what to do with our psyches when that begins to happen. The economic problem isn't the main one. Not that somebody should, give you a fishing rod and send you out fishing and then have dinner for you when you come home. It's what are you going to do with that power inside you? You've become somewhat aware of the world, of the mystery of the world, and you just don't want to go doodling along with silly little children tasks, and that's not what you're worth. It's not what you're ready for. There are problems to face. The most challenging one is death. Man is the only animal that knows he's going to die. And as soon as you fumble that ball, it's coming. Schopenhauer has a wonderful line somewhere. He says, the first half of life, when there's a knock on the door, you think, here it comes. And the last half of life, when there's a knock on the door, you think, here it comes. So, we find this wonderful problem, and the mythologies in general, the religions, have served it. They have provided images and tasks and disciplines that carry the child from childhood dependency to responsibility, rather simple responsibilities, those that the society says you've got to accept, and then they've provided a way out. They tell you that daddy will be up there and you're going back home. Now, this isn't quite enough anymore, either. Is it any wonder that our clergymen look a little bit anxious these days? Now, I just want to speak about the phases in the development of any mythology. How does it start, and what happens to it? I think one could say this, that all of the high cultures and low cultures and primitive cultures and charming simple cultures and great big enormous ones have grown out of myths. They are founded on myths. And what these myths have given has been inspiration for aspiration. The economic interpretation of history is for the birds. Economics is itself a function of aspiration. It's what people aspire to that creates the field in which economics works. And people who don't have any aspirations, the problem of a businessman who can't get people to want anything. It's the want. It's the aspiration. And what is wanted is not simply one, two, or three meals a day in a bed. That's not enough. It's got to be much more than that to make a life. Now, where do these aspirations come from? They come from a very wonderful childlike thing, fascination. You know, if you wanted to make money today, I'm no economist, but I'll bet the thing to do would be to invest your money in something like cameras. Things that people play with. Things that they're fascinated by. These fascinations are the creations of new activities. And when we look at the old cultures, we can see, and some of it is very strange to see indeed. What is most fascinating to begin with is one's neighbor. particularly if the neighbor is a very strange-looking creature. Now, think of man in the old days. He was a minority on the planet. And when he looked at his neighbors, they had 4 feet, they had horns, they had great woolly bodies. They were very strange playmates. Furthermore, he was eating certain of them, and they were rather dangerous. He had to arrange some kind of arrangement with his neighbors, namely these animals. And we know that the first religious rites and the first religious address, so to say, was to animals, their neighbors. These were the images of God, as our neighbors are today, but they're not four-footed for the most part. Some of them act that way, but they're not. The animal world was the first inspiration, and the divinities were animal divinities. And not only that, but just as kids, when they identify with something, when they are fascinated by something, they act like it. They play it. So, the original rituals, the hunting people, danced buffalo dances, deer dances, called themselves after the names. Their tribes were called weasels and buffaloes and all these things. They were in covenant, so to say, with the animal world. And the notion was, this is a very interesting thing, that through this covenant, the animals gave their bodies willingly to be eaten, because only the body dies. The being comes back. If you return the blood of the animal to the earth, the life is in the blood. The earth is the mother of life, and the animal will be back next year. A fundamental hunting right. If you want the animals to be back next year, you have to perform this. People who lived then in the plant world, the world of the tropics, where nature was a plant world, they saw something else. They saw that out of rot, out of decay, there comes life. And this notion that out of death comes life becomes a very important thing in the tropical cultures. And it led to what us is a very horrible pattern of rituals. Rituals of human sacrifice. Killing people. Letting them rot. Burying them with the notion that out of this death there would come life. In Indonesia, Borneo, the old headhunters, the idea was that before a young man could marry and beget life, he had to kill life. He had to get ahead. And if you've ever witnessed any movie or by any other means, the representation of a Borneo marriage ceremony, the head is right there when the young couple are having their wedding dinner and the head is being fed. And the youngster who's going to be born is going to have the name of the man who had that head. That man's coming back. This notion that out of death comes life becomes a very important theme in the later religions of the world. He who loses his life shall find it, is a spiritualization of this idea. Then, when the first cities appear in Mesopotamia, about 3000 BC, large communities grow up based on agriculture. The planting has to take place a certain time, reaping a certain time, and there are professional priests watching the heavens to to know when those times were, when those times came. And those men became aware of the movement of the planets through the fixed stars. And they calculated and recognized that these planets were moving in mathematically inevitable courses. And the idea came into being at this time in Mesopotamia of a cosmic order of mathematical precision. On and on, eons, as the day comes and goes, the year comes and goes, the eons come and go, and the whole society must go into accord with that. This idea that the human society should reproduce the heavenly order comes in. The neighbors now were the stars and the planets, and this still lives with us in our religions. All of our religions have inherited this motif from the old Babylonian world. It went out with the higher civilizations to India, to China, even across the Pacific, to Mexico and Peru. And you see these great towers, these great temple towers that represent the mountain of the world, and on it's the axis of the world around which the world turns, as it does around the pole star. The whole world and society and the individual in it are like the planets moving in a great course. Now in the 1920s, Sir Leonard Woolley, excavating in the old city of Ur, remember Abraham, the man from Ur, he left the ziggurats. Sir Leonard Woolley, excavating in the graveyards of Ur, found graves in which there were 30 and 40 people buried, all of them in court attire, who had been buried alive. When the king died or was killed, at a certain time in the movement of the planets, when the moon goes down and the planet Venus along with the moon, that was the end of an eon, the king and his entire court walked into the grave. They were playing a game. Just as the hunters were imitating animals, just as the planting people were imitating plants, so the high civilizations began with princely, aristocratic little groups imitating the stars to the death, going all the way. The whole court, at the end of an eon, went in the grave so that another court could come. And it's a very poetic thing, really. The harpists, the little girls who played the harps, we have these harps. They have been excavated and restored. These little skeleton hands, the girls' hands were still on the harp strings. The women in one of the graves had golden hair ribbons. One girl didn't have her golden hair ribbon on. It was found, thank you, Sasha, in her pocket. She had been late for the party and hadn't had time to put her ribbon on. Well, now we don't do that anymore. That kind of action has fallen into desuetude. Nevertheless, the king still wears the golden crown of the sun. The kingly paraphernalia of the installation of Queen Elizabeth and so forth, or of the burial of Winston Churchill a couple of years ago, was an imitation of these heavenly movements. And even in our own country, the burial of President Kennedy, those horses with their black feet, their feet blackened, the color of the horse, the cannon and so forth, the number of the horses, the horse with his inverted stirrups and all of these are imitations of old rites in which the king is dead and his vehicle, his horse, is going with him. The sense has gone, yet the poetry somehow echoes. What happens is that the old fascination disappears. An echo remains, and you have, as it were, the vestige of a mythology. The problem of our present age is to recreate the mythology for today, on which people will live, on which the society will grow. It is being done. It's being done well. People aren't always looking in the right place for it, but it is taking shape. Our great artists, our great poets, our great scientists. Read, for example, Erwin Schrödinger's little book, My View of the World. This is a vision of a poet and of a first-rate physical scientist. And it has the same song in it that one reads and hears in the old Upanishads and in the sayings of the great prophets, right out of today's experience. Nature is still ours. It is in us. It is in the universe. And what it shows is that tremendum, that mystery that was shown in the first place. And that's the basic problem of the poet and of the myth, as I said in the first place, to reconcile consciousness to its own source, namely nature, and or what one might conceive to be within or behind nature. Secondary to that is the social situation. Now, in our society, the social problem is turned over largely to the police and to Congress. It's a purely practical matter. However, the creatures that constitute the society, these are today the neighbor. They really are. The idea of a personal God living somehow, somewhere else, out there, there is no out there anymore, there's no more up there. It's awfully difficult to validate. But it seems to me if one's looking for the personality of God, it's right here in the multitudinous personalities of those around us. Everything I find in the poets, in the scientists, who push through to this mystery points not to the animals as our neighbors, not to the plants, not to the planet, but to that other one, the thou whom you face, who's not the thou you would want him to be. He's other. And it's that recognition of otherness that is absolutely basic and necessary. Now, this doesn't mean that you have to give up your otherness in recognition of him. There may darn well be collision. But it's got to be collision with reverence and respect. I've been reading recently a great many medieval works. And these involve, particularly in the Arthurian romances and so forth, knights in combat with each other, fiercely in combat, with complete respect for each other, even love for each other. And there's one wonderful line in Wolfram von Eschenbach, when two brothers, who didn't know they were brothers, were in combat. In fact, they were half-brothers. One was a Christian, and the other was a Mohammedan. They were in combat. And Wolfram says, if one wished to think of it that way, one could say that they were two battling. But they had the same father, and they are one. And they are one, battling himself out of loyalty, out of honor, and doing himself much harm. But that's the tragic sense. As I say, life begins, and that's the thing, the first thing the eye sees. Life eating itself, killing. But that's life. And the reconciliation of consciousness, which revolts from this, to that, and its affirmation, that is the song of mythology. It has been. It's the song of the religions. And with that little affirmative theme, the affirmation of life as is, I would say we have the key to the hopping up, the stepping up, the invigorating of life, which has been the function, actually, the first function of mythology from the time the old cavemen asked the bear to give his body for their life. So with that little theme, I'll close with thanks to you all.
Been listening to The Celebration of Life, the first talk by Joseph Campbell in the series entitled Mythology and the Individual. This recording was authorized by the Joseph Campbell Foundation and produced by Electronic Educational Programs. Our theme music is by Acoustic Alchemy. For more information on the works of Joseph Campbell, please call the Foundation at 1-800-330-MYTH, 1-800-330-6984, or you can contact us on the World Wide Web at jcf.org. I'm Maura Vaughn. Thank you for listening.